From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Vijay Vaidheswaran isn't a preacher, far from it. He's a hard-nosed writer for The Economist magazine. But after a decade of covering the environment and energy, he is also a true believer in the green future of the automobile. Oil, he says, is the problem, not cars. Cars, he says, will be green, and whoever makes them green will be rich. We'll hear his case and some skeptical pushback. This hour, On Point, the global climate, the U.S. economy, and the planet-wide race for the truly green car. We'll go to cars in a second, but first, quickly, to oil. It topped $90 a barrel on Friday. Peter Coy, an economics editor at Business Week magazine, joins us from New York. Peter, where's oil headed today?
Oil's down a little bit today, back down to around 85 or so on the December contract on the New York Mercantile Exchange. News is that the Defense Secretary, Robert Gates, is predicting that Turkey will not attack rebels in northern Iraq anytime soon. At the same time, people are thinking that maybe some of the economic turmoil in the United States will slow world growth a little bit, decreasing demand projections.
So that means maybe we're easing up here, but just the idea of back down to $85 a barrel is already sort of a stunner, and we've had lots of people in recent weeks saying it could easily go to 100 soon.
It certainly could. I mean, we're in such an unstable situation now. We have tight global supplies, and we have this continued threat of geopolitical trouble in so many different spots around the world, from Nigeria to, of course, Iraq and throughout Central Asia, that any big blow-up could do that, could send oil over into the triple digits.
If that happens, Peter, is that an economy killer in itself? I mean, I assume that just a handful of years ago, people would have thought so. $100 a barrel oil, does it now look calamitous or like something that will just push economic change, but economies will take in stride?
It'll slow the economy, inevitably. People say, I had this in the magazine this week, $10 per barrel change in the price of oil cuts maybe 0.25% off the growth rate. Our problem in the U.S. now, as I wrote, is that we have already a huge drag in the economy from housing. Mm-hmm. And so this is just adding insult to injury.
Do people who follow oil, do you see it ever floating back down in that, you know, happy days, free oil kind of zone? You know, I mean, it got down to in the teens not so very long ago, and the 20s
and
$30 a barrel.
This is hard to believe now, but in 1998, oil briefly got down to $10 a barrel.
I mean, and no one would have thought that was coming. Could that happen again, or are we all finished with cheap oil in this world?
You know, stranger things have happened. If OPEC lost its discipline, increased production a lot, and if we had serious economic downturn, this is not something we want to happen, but the main thing that would cause oil to drop a lot would be worldwide recession.
Mm. But if you're sitting in Detroit or in Tokyo at the head of a car company or Korea or China for that matter, and automobiles are your business, do they have to now count or imagine that it's going to be that high oil scenario for the foreseeable future?
They have to, simply for planning purposes, because if they overestimate the price of oil, all they have is, you know, cars that are needlessly efficient.
Mm.
Whereas if they underestimate the price of oil, they completely lose their market.
And that hurts. Peter Coy, thanks very much for being with us on Oil Today.
Thank you.
Peter Coy, economics editor at Business Week magazine. He spoke with us from New York. We're talking this hour about the race for big bucks and maybe green salvation in a new kind of car. Joining me from New York is Vijay Vaidheswaran, MIT-trained engineer and correspondent for The Economist magazine. He's co-author with Ian Carson of the new book, Zoom, The Global Race to Fuel the Car of the Future. Vijay, thanks very much for being with us.
It's great to be here.
You say oil is the problem, cars are not the problem, but you say that as though those are fighting words. That hasn't always been the perspective out there, has it?
No, not at all. On the contrary, I think for a lot of people, you know, SUVs are the work of the devil. And a lot of people who are concerned about the problems that America faces, whether it's geopolitical tangles in the Middle East, whether it's the environmental harm of local pollution, global warming, or whether it's the harm that, you know, the way we drive leads to harm in our children's lungs and the healthcare system, the environmental pollution or global warming aspects of it. All these things people associate with cars. My argument is actually Those are all troubles caused by burning gasoline. The car itself is an engine of freedom, of mobility. It really brings prosperity, independence, autonomy, a lot of good things that we can separate out from the burning of a particularly dirty fossil fuel, meaning gasoline.
So for the mass transit bicycle riding brigade, those are kind of fighting words, but you actually go a little further and you suggest, as I read you, that the car may be a salvation for a world plagued by oil tensions and climate change. How?
Here's how. Of course, the first and important starting principle for any conversation like this is we need to have meaningful choices. And I spend a lot of the book explaining how public transportation, how smart lessons, even from developing countries, Curitiba, Brazil, and Bogota, Colombia, have pioneered bus rapid transit systems. We need paradigms for smarter growth, not just exurban growth like we have gone in America. We subsidize and have lots of, you know, sort of distortions that encourage resource-intensive development in America. I argue quite forcefully that we should reverse these trends in America over the long term, and that China and India and Brazil and South Africa, the big giants of the developing world, and show how they're already beginning to put in smarter systems, smart cities from the beginning before they get to the stage of development that we're at. But within that context, that conversation about having choices, I think it's really unproductive and frankly a little bit silly to demonize the car. The car is an aspiration. It's also a vehicle that is a wonderful tool of personal mobility. Mm. Once you get it to clean fuels, you deal with the geopolitical problems, you deal with the economic shock potential, just what we've been discussing today, the price of oil, the cartels that manipulate it, often undemocratic regimes. You move away from the environmental harm done by burning fossil fuels, and you keep a lot of the things that are good, which again tie into the engines of prosperity. And more than that, because we can change cars more often than we change coal-fired power plants, that those stay in the ground 30, 40 years. If you want to move the energy system to decarbonize, that is to become cleaner, more friendly in terms of carbon emissions, and ultimately more sustainable, to be a smarter grid with more intelligence on it, more resilient, like the internet, not like the very brittle, fragile network that we have now. If you start by saying, let's take on the coal plants, well, those guys last 30, 40, 50 years. Mm. Cars, people change cars every 3 to 5 years, and on average, the fleet expectations are much faster. So you have an engine of change that can actually drive new technologies, clean technologies, into the energy system. And I think over time, we are going to see the smart cars of the future, which are all getting more and more electrified, ultimately integrate with the power grid, what's called vehicle-to-grid.
Right.
And we're going to see a real dramatic change. So by making affirmative choices in the marketplace for things that we have a connection with, cars, we can actually change the entire energy system.
Vijay, let's get nitty-gritty here. You say cars can drive the change, and who doesn't love the mobility and freedom of an automobile? And we know there are millions, maybe billions more people in developing countries who want to share in that. But I guess part of the pushback on cars has come from the disbelief that they can be cleaned up in time to address the climate change that looks so urgent right now. What gives you the confidence that huge number of cars can be flipped green, you know, in time to keep up with the problem?
Well, that's an important question, and that has to do with capital stock turnover, right? Of course, we're not flipping over cars like we do cell phones, where people get the latest iPhone or whatever it is every 6 months or a year. But when we look at the energy system, history suggests energy systems transition from wood to coal, to oil, to gas, to something else. These things happen in the space of 50, 60, 70 years. We don't have that kind of time if we're going to come seriously to grips with climate change and also with the geopolitics of oil, which are going to get worse in the next 10 to 20
years. I'm trying
to
make another point, I think, which is that people may not even believe that you're going to be able to provide a green car on the scale for your capital stock turnover, even in the auto sector. I mean, where has confidence come from that the technology is there to build all those green cars quickly enough to keep up with the problem?
Well, you know, that this is not a question of a lack of technology. Let's remember, 100 years ago, on the streets of New York City and Boston, there were more electric cars on the road than there were gasoline cars. And Henry Ford's Model T was a flexible fuel vehicle. It could run on ethanol or on gasoline. So the idea that, you know, technologies can't be brought to bear in a mass production way, we've done it before. We made choices in the marketplace and oil companies became dominant in the marketplace. And we've seen these symbiotic twins, the internal combustion engine and the gasoline, really sort of joined at the hip. The good news is they're headed for divorce. And to answer your question quite bluntly, how quickly? In the time frame that any of our listeners are likely to go and buy a new car, that is, you know, in the 5 to 7 years that most Americans change over their cars, we're going to see a variety of technologies. One of them will be electric. For example, next year, we're going to have the first new American car company in many decades called Tesla Motors. It started by a Silicon Valley luminary, giving a 100% electric car, sports car. It's faster than a Ferrari, goes 250 miles on a charge. Tesla Roadster, I mean, I've driven this car. It's pretty amazing. You can be faster than a Ferrari, greener than a Prius, starting next year. Just to give one small example, within 3 to 5 years, we're going to see what's called plug-in hybrid cars. These are gasoline cars, but that you plug in overnight. The first 30 or 40 miles you drive, and these are coming from companies like Chevrolet, the mass market American brand, not, you know, an obscure Chinese car maker. But since I mentioned it, the real disruptive innovations, again, in the time frame for people to buy these cars, will be coming, you know, from the software guys in Bangalore and the Chinese car companies like Chery and some of the other rivals that are among the world leaders.
Vijay, we've got lots of people who want to speak with you. Let's go to George in Cambridge, Massachusetts. George, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. This is a fairly realistic discussion of what's going on. From my point of view, the time frame is very, very difficult. James Hansen of NASA about a year and a half ago said we had about a decade before we go into cataclysmic climate change, and that was a year and a half ago, so now we have
eight and a half, maybe.
Right. And a few weeks ago, Tim Flannery, another atmospheric scientist from Australia, said that the latest IPCC report, which is due in November, will say we've already passed that point of no return, which I believe is 455 parts per million of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Furthermore, according to what I've read on the oil drum, it seems as if we might have reached peak oil a year or two ago, and nobody is in power is actually dealing with that. And as has been stated here, it's probably about 7 to 10 years to turn over the fleet of cars that are on the road now.
So, George, we see your question coming, but put it for us.
Well, I don't want to be pessimistic. I want to be realistic. If this is the time frame, I don't see how it happens. And it's going to be very, very difficult. Perhaps we should be spending much more time and energy on making the railroads work again than on trying to deal with car systems that won't even be available within that decade time frame.
George, you make the skeptical case very well. Vijay, what do you say to it?
Sure. And I share the concern expressed by the caller. What I would point out is that that's one of the main reasons why I argue that simply focusing on electricity and coal, most people who are concerned with climate change would you can't have a conversation without coal and China coming up in the first sentence. I argue that, in fact, precisely because capital stock turnover is so important, the more difficult problem we need to grapple with and the one we need to really mobilize political change around is transportation. And this is one where the capital stock does turn over faster. People are willing to pay for new cars. Most Americans, and indeed most people around the world, don't think about power stations. It's not something that has an emotional connection. Well, we're not motivated to think about it, except for a few people who are very environmentally minded.
But Vijay, let me just ask you, if every American, never mind the rest of the world, were ready in just a half a dozen years to buy a car based on a very different energy source and technology, is it going to be there and be there in the volume and availability that would make that turnover possible? What gives you the confidence that it will?
Once you see incentives for market pull, in other words, I think that you're going to see a nonlinear change. And this is how Al Gore talks about the political system, and I think he's right, and not just because he has a Nobel Prize, of course. He's been saying it before then. Change in American political process, just as it does when it comes in markets like the car industry or energy industry, happens in nonlinear fashion. For a long time, it appears nothing is going to happen. If you look at Washington and climate policy, for example, over the last 10 years, it's been a bloody draw, a stalemate in Washington. Not much has happened. But I predict in this book, and I document how, because of a bottom-up uprising, really, from people like our concerned caller, like the state governors, like rural electric cooperatives, concerned citizens, both from the left and the right, demanding change. There's a great awakening across America demanding action in the form of meaningful global warming policies. I predict it'll happen in the next 2 years. It might have to be after President Bush leaves office.
But that's interesting. You're not pointing to markets. I just have to ask about that. You're not pointing first to markets or to technology. You're pointing first to politics and saying that has to push this change?
There are both things matter. We need a level playing field. Mm. Now, we spent the first 20 minutes of our conversation talking about markets. Market pull is very important. And ultimately, I have tremendous faith in the innovation capacity of America. We're the most innovative capacity on economy on earth. You know, we invented Silicon Valley, the most of the internet, much of the digital economy. Almost every disruptive innovation of the last 40 years has come from America. And when we get serious about climate change and energy, we will solve the problem for the world. I'm confident about that. But we are not yet serious as long as our economy and our consumers are working with, in a sense, an unlevel playing field. The Washington policies we have on energy are so perversely tilted towards dirty energies. It's atrocious, the kinds of subsidies, the kinds of tax distortions, and ultimately the lack of meaningful prices for gasoline, for dirty coals. Mm. We pay an unrealistic price,
so
very
you say,
low price.
Yep, the market will demand it, you say. Policy will have to change radically and soon to change it. But let's go to the technology piece, if we could, Vijay, for a second here.
Sure.
What's out there that could clean cars enough, radically enough, quickly enough, and it's realistic enough in time frame to turn cars into kind of, you know, little green buggies?
Well, I think there's a multiplicity of – this is the beauty of the change. It's happening much faster than people think. The caller despaired in terms of time frames. But if we look, for example, at a country like Brazil, a country that has a fraction of the wealth that America does. Now, Brazil is not a wealthy country like America. 85% of the new cars in Brazil that are sold today can run perfectly well on either ethanol or on gasoline. Mm. And most of the time they do run on ethanol, this alternative fuel. It's made in a very environmentally friendly way in Brazil from sugarcane. Now, we could do this in America. Certainly those cars could be available. We could use that environmentally benign fuel, ethanol made from sugarcane. I mentioned it especially because it's distinct from the way we make ethanol in America today from corn, which is an environmental loser. It's sort of a pork barrel giveaway for Midwestern farmers. If we get serious in Washington, move beyond the pork barrel politics that in a sense the energy and agriculture lobbies have kept us trapped in. And I see this happening. I see a real momentum for change in Washington for the first time in 10 years that I've looked at this very closely. I think we can have a real breakthrough. The technologies are actually at the ready. The hard part is not the technologies. It's the political will. That's why I'm hopeful, because at right now, I think Americans are much more galvanized to the point where I think this will be the next great revolution in American politics.
Interesting. Let's go to Detroit. We've got caller John from Detroit. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
To me, it sounds like Zoom should be right on the shelf with Tom Friedman's book, The World is Flat. And my question coming from
your mouth to Amazon's ears.
And the bestseller list. Okay. What's your question, John?
Being a casual observer of the automotive industry here in Detroit, I don't see the infrastructure in the corporations as well as the unions for these vehicles to be built in the United States. Maybe designed, like you said, the software and the technology can come from here, but what are we doing? Vijay, you say that Chevrolet has something. What can you shine some more light on what the U.S. car manufacturers are going to do to participate in this?
John, thanks. Sure. Vijay, there's the skeptical note right from Motor City.
Absolutely, but it asks the right question. How can Detroit respond, or can it? I mean, Detroit has the problem of legacy assets, as it's called, right? Mm-hmm. We have steel stamping facilities. We have union contracts. Mm-hmm. We have old ways of doing business. And we have corporate leadership that throughout the 1990s, in a sense, stuck its head in the sand and said, you know, we're not going to innovate. We're not going to be ready for a world that was already pretty clear. It was entering an era of carbon constraints, meaning dealing with global warming.
And union leadership, too, saying don't push higher miles per gallon on us. It'll kill our business.
You better believe it, both sides. Mm-hmm. So Detroit leadership relied on political lobbying in Washington rather than world-class engineering excellence in Detroit, which we still have and in which I'm a big believer. The challenge, but that's exactly why I think there's hope. If we were to break through the political logjam that, in a sense, Detroit thought was helping America, right? The old days we used to say what's good for GM is good for America. Honestly, with the way that the leadership has portrayed it, that what's good for GM hasn't been good for America. That 90s thinking that led to a lot of Hummers and SUVs being built in a very heavy and inefficient way, using gasoline very inefficiently. We're at a 20-year low in terms of fuel economy. Henry Ford's Model T got better fuel economy than the average new car today. You're telling me we can't do better than this? Of course we can. These are choices that are made. And I think if we break through the logjam, and equally, as consumers, we demand better. Right? In a sense, give the people what they want. If we demand better from our car makers and car makers see market opportunity in it, and we get that level playing field of public policy rather than the distorted kind of policies we have that favor big autos, I mean, mistakenly favor them, thinking we're helping America. These things have actually hurt us competitively, allowed the Japanese to take the lead. Toyota is the number one car maker in the world, mainly because we gave it up. And I think there's every opportunity to leapfrog ahead of Japan right here with homegrown technologies. Among things, plug-in hybrids. You mentioned Chevy. Mm. The Chevy Volt is a model that GM has in development that would put it ahead of Toyota and the Prius in the space of 5 years. They're putting a lot of very smart engineers onto it, and they're giving it, for once, top management attention. I want to see whether they back it up, you know, back up the words with action. But I can see that there's a seriousness of purpose in Detroit that I did not see during the 1990s.
So you mentioned Tokyo. Let's go there and get a perspective there. Vijay Vaitheeswaran is with us. He's co-author of the new book, Zoom, The Global Race to Fuel the Car of the Future. And Vijay, we love your optimism, but we know that time is tight and politics around this issue are very tough indeed. Joining us now from Tokyo, Japan, is Joseph White. He's Detroit bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, writes the Eyes on the Road column. He's in Japan for the Tokyo Auto Show, which opens this week. Joe White, thanks very much for being here.
Sure. Hi.
Hi. So Vijay and Ian Carson say, you know what? It's not the car that's the problem. It's oil. The car may save our bacon here. What do you say, Joe?
Oh boy, I wish it were that simple. And I did go through the book, and it's got a lot of really good points in it. But I have to say that I guess from the perspective of someone who's covered the car industry for a while, I think maybe the book is a bit optimistic. I mean, I just spent the day at Toyota, and they have a much more sober and restrained view of how much can be done with automotive technology and alternative fuels over the next 5 or 10 years. I mean, they're certainly not promising plug-in hybrids anytime soon, and they have a lot of experience with hybrids, and they have a great deal of skepticism around the Chevy Volt, which I guess you'd expect. But I guess, you know, in talking with people at Toyota and talking with people at GM, the thing that strikes me is, you know, that if this were easy, it's like people say about baseball, if this were easy, everybody would do it. It's not easy. Every single one of these alternative fuels and alternative technologies has a major problem. Biofuels in the United States, and Vijay, I heard you say this, and you're absolutely right, the corn ethanol is just a total loser. But even other kinds of biofuel crops are problematic. Because it's hard to distribute the ethanol fuels around the country, and you need a whole lot of water to grow these fuels, and we don't have it.
Watch out, aquifers, if that's where we go.
Yeah, I mean, Atlanta's on a 90-day countdown to no water. I mean, who'd have thunk it? I mean, and this is so everywhere you pull on this ball of twine, you discover that there are just enormously complex issues.
What about hydrogen? Hydrogen or something that doesn't come out of a field?
2015 at the best, and the question is, where do you get the hydrogen from? Right now, I'm sure Vijay could correct me if I'm wrong. Right now, much of the hydrogen that's used for fuels is, or would be, if you could distribute it, cracked from natural gas or some other hydrocarbon.
And that takes energy to do.
And that takes energy too. You know, I don't want to come on acting like the guy who's carrying the auto industry's water. It's the farthest thing from what I want to do. But I guess I am persuaded that the sort of bottom-up kind of uprising that the authors are talking about in their book, it's great, But at the end of the day, you're dealing with companies and individuals who have very little capital, and the people who have the capital and have the means and have the technology, they see a lot of constraints to this, and I just don't see something happening in a couple of years.
Vijay, what do you say? Joe's been talking with Toyota in Japan. Here's Toyota. You know, they who brought us the Prius, and they're skeptical about a fast march here.
Toyota is a wonderful company. They're also very, very cautious in their public statements. I talk with Toyota quite regularly, and in fact, they were cautious to the point where a year ago they said plug-in hybrids can't happen, won't do it. And amazingly, they announced a few months ago, oh, by the way, we've secretly had a plug-in hybrid program, and we're going to put these cars on the road in California. So I would take with a grain of salt Toyota's public caution, unlike GM and the American car companies, who often trumpet things then sometimes don't deliver. Toyota takes the other approach. They would rather keep it quiet and surprise the markets, as they did with the Prius, which was poo-pooed by everyone in Detroit, and ultimately is now a top 10 car in America. Toyota sold
top 18, and they've only sold 1 million hybrids worldwide. They just were mentioning that figure. I think the Prius is a great car. I think they should be selling 500,000 a year, but you have to recognize that it's still an emerging technology.
Vijay, what about biofuels? Not enough water. Hydrogen? Not to 2015. We're out of our time frame.
I think that there's no silver bullet, and that's one of the points that this book makes. I think it's one of the key ways to think about the future. For a long time, advocates of anything other than oil have gotten themselves trapped into a ghetto where they'd say it has to be only electric cars, or they bash hydrogen. Or the hydrogen guys, they don't like the biofuels. Well, the truth is every one of these alternatives has some kind of issue. It might be a chicken and egg question with infrastructure. It may be, you know, the energy conversion ratios. My argument is that as the car itself electrifies, and this is one of the mega trends over the last 25 years, we've gone from, say, in 1970, 5% of the input value of a car might have been the electronics. We've increased to perhaps 20% of the car now is the software, the electronics. Almost all of the innovation in cars is in the software, the brains of the operation, the hardware, related computer systems. We're marching on towards electrifying the automobile, towards being a multiple fuel, a flex fuel vehicle that's smart. And the Prius is not the car of the future, but it's an important stepping stone in terms of the electronics towards all the cars that come. Once you have flexible fuels, you can always have a small gasoline tank. You might use it only once a week or once in a month if you don't charge your plug-in or whatever other reason. You drive by, there's no ethanol where you are. In Brazil, for example, people have the flexible fuel capability that gives them the confidence to adopt a new kind of fuel. Then you suddenly see a way out of this old chicken and egg paradigm. Different parts of the world will use different kinds of fuels. It doesn't have to be a silver bullet or a giant slayer. That's my argument, that the future will involve a portfolio of technologies, just like when we talk about electricity. Nobody seriously says that solar energy is going to be 100% of all electricity. That's silly. You know, nor should nuclear be. We want to hedge our bets. Similarly with automotive technologies, getting almost all of our automotive fuel energy from gasoline, a particularly troublesome fuel, even though its energy density is extraordinary, it's very good at what it does. It's actually got so many associated problems. I say let's bet on a portfolio of fuels, with gasoline being one of the runners that will help us bridge over to a world where there could never be an OPEC of biofuels or a cartel controlling electricity, because anybody anywhere in the world could make these things.
We're talking this hour about the race to wean the automobile off fossil fuels and maybe save the planet in the process. Vijay Vaitheswaran is with us. He's co-author with Ian Carson of the new book Zoom, The Global Race to Fuel the Car of the Future. Joseph White joins us as well. He's Detroit bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, but he's in Tokyo, Japan this week for the Tokyo Auto Show. Let's go to Zach in Madison, Wisconsin. Zach, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm wondering why we're talking about cars when we could be copying Europe and China and developing rail transportation, trains. It seems to me that we're trying to streamline our bad habits instead of developing good ones.
Vijay, what do you say to Zach?
I think you're absolutely right, and I devote a lot of the book talking about how we need to rethink our paradigm for urban transportation and how we do cities, showing as an example not only Europe or Japan, but also developing countries, China, India, these countries most of the urban infrastructure that they're going to have in 2020 or 2050, meaning most of the roads, most of the subways, haven't even been built yet. So they have a real opportunity to go green from the beginning with smart growth and public transportation, bike lanes, things that, you know, we have taken 50 to 100 years to build a suburban style of living, freeways, ultimately the exurbs now that are so resource intensive. I argue that is an important part of the future. However, if you just say that, you're letting the ideal be the enemy of the good. Here's why. We have to live in the world we are in America. And if you're a working person in America who has to take your kids to soccer and you know get them to school safely, you have to go about your job, simply being lectured at by environmentalists saying you should take the bus is not really very helpful when for 95% of Americans that's not a meaningful option. We haven't invested in those choices yet. I personally, I've written a book about cars. I love cars. I think they play a role in the future. I don't own a car. I live in Manhattan, and I'm lucky enough to have one of the world's best subway systems. But I appreciate the fact that most of my fellow Americans don't have the luxury I do of the investments made by my wise forefathers in New York. I argue we should make those investments, but climate change can't wait for most of America to have meaningful public transport. We need to green the car as well. And ultimately, I think that can be consistent in a future in which we have green options for all of us. And there'll be times when it does make sense to have green personal transport, and there'll be times when, and I encourage this, green public transport as well.
Joe White in Tokyo, let me go to you here. I mean, Vijay says, you know, because people turn their cars over more frequently than they do power plants, let's say, there's a capital stock turnover opportunity here. Green the car and you green the planet. You're expressing skepticism about the time frame there. So if it's not going to happen in the time frame that Vijay is hoping, wishing, pushing for, saying is possible, then the car, if it doesn't save us, is the car the thing that kills us? I mean, in China and a lot of other countries, people are making more money. They want their cars now as well.
Well, yeah, that's true, I've been to China recently, and from reading the book, it's clear Vijay has as well. I mean, the unfortunate thing is that China right now, you know, if you go there, it looks more like they're repeating our mistakes in half the time, rather than avoiding them. But yeah, you know, look, this stuff is complicated. Cars, as I understand it, and this, you get all kinds of numbers from people, but cars, as I understand it, account for about 20% of the human generated CO2 that is the problem with global warming. First of all, you know, that's a big chunk and you ought to deal with it, but there's the other 80% as well. And I think you have to sort of attack on all fronts. The car industry isn't strong enough to do this on its own, certainly not the Detroit car companies. And like it or not, they account for a lot of what we're talking about here. I've kind of come to the conclusion personally that without some sort of boost, and you know, we can argue for the rest of the hour if you like about whether that should be a tax incentive, a tax disincentives, gas taxes, congestion taxes, you name it, some kind of thing that equalizes the cost hurdle for new technology.
Yep.
And encourages people to invest in it and turn their fleet, you know, turn their cars over rather than just hanging on to them, is something we got to do. I mean, I can tell you that one of the nightmare scenarios for the car guys is that they'll bring out these terrific alternative fuel cars that will be more expensive, and then people will hang on to their old monsters, you know, yeah, will sort of turn into a, you know, 21st century version of Cuba.
Right, driving a 30 years later.
Yeah, I mean, that's a nightmare scenario, but this is the kind of stuff that keeps these guys awake at night.
Vijay, what's your prescription here? You say it's going to take a political push, and Joe begins to get specific about what that might be. Are you talking gas tax or somehow radically raising those CAFE standards that have crept up so slowly for so long? $90 a barrel of oil isn't enough on its own. If that's not enough to change Detroit and maybe Tokyo, what will it take?
I'm delighted that he's mentioned the four-letter word of American politics, tax. You know, you mentioned this in Washington, immediately you're drummed out of any office or any hearing. In fact, you know, I think that we need honest prices for fossil fuels, coal and gasoline included. And I think the right way to get there is something like a carbon tax, an economy-wide carbon tax. But here's why I think there's a new proposal that Zoom includes that I think is the way to go. I don't want to make ordinary Americans any poorer. And I think that's very important that any kind of carbon tax like the one I advocate. I call it a tax refund. Here's how it would work. The next president would announce, with the support of a bipartisan congressional bill, a new energy independence bill. You could call it anything you like. Mm. That starts with a tax refund. Every month from now on, you're going to get a tax refund as an American household. That's politically powerful, right? Everyone loves a refund. We've already
seen
that. From
where? Where does it come from?
There you go. But in return, we're going to all have to pitch in to change the nature of our economy, our energy economy. We're going to have a carbon tax that's revenue neutral. Every penny the government takes in by imposing this carbon tax, and a carbon tax basically is a tax that is on fuels like oil, like coal, things that have carbon in them that contribute to global warming, that have this effect on the economy and that have the geopolitical problems.
So a tax on gasoline and my home heating oil and anything. Any carbon tax every time I touch
remember,
carbon?
I started by giving you a nice refund check.
Okay,
so you're already on my side. And I tell you, and not only that, you're going to help America do something proactive about climate change.
Right.
You're going to do something proactive about getting us off of oil. And in the way it would manifest itself, you say, let's say there'd be a gasoline tax increase. Again, under a bipartisan 20-year accord, gasoline taxes would go up a nickel or a dime a gallon every month for the next 20 years. Now, the exact number, you know, 100 economists can argue about till they die. But the point is, you suddenly get a market signal. And what does this do? If a couple is thinking about buying their next car, they might say, you know, honey, we kind of see, I mean, a nickel a gallon, that's not really that much, but we kind of see the direction it's going and it's going to add up. Why don't we buy a slightly smaller SUV next time? The guys in Detroit, when they're making investment decisions, rather than miss out again like they did on hybrids, they might say, you know, why don't we accelerate our program in alternative fuels? We see which way the market's going. Not only that, because there's going to be a more level playing field for clean technologies, which is the point that Joe made, that we can have a real chance to compete against some of the dirty options.
Right.
And Americans believe in honest pricing. And under this scheme, if you had seven Hummers like Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know what? You're probably going to pay a little more for gasoline. But if you're actually buying energy-efficient vehicles, you drive a Prius and a bicycle, you know what? You're going to make off a winner, and you should, because you're helping America build a cleaner economy.
I think this is the way to think about it. I want to put that to Joe. Joe, I don't hear a candidate on the stump quite proposing that at the moment. But let's say somebody did and it sold. Would that be enough to, you know, start up the rollover Beethoven tune for Detroit? Would it change what Detroit's doing radically, quickly?
Detroit, and no car maker can change what they're doing radically, quickly. They can change what they're doing radically and slowly. Cars operate on a 4 to 5 year product cycle, and actually, depending on how you look at it, it might be even 10. I mean, look, I mean, there's no question, Vijay, I agree with Vijay. If you don't have a price signal, you're nowhere. There is actually someone proposing this. It's John Dingell, the congressman from Michigan, and he's viewed as a mischievous old dinosaur because he represents the car industry in Washington, but he's absolutely right in what he's proposing. He's proposing a broad-based carbon tax and various other measures to sort of bring forward the true price of the way we live. Mm. I mean, you can live in the future if you just fly to Europe. Europe has a $6, maybe even more, gallon gasoline, and various incentives to buy fuel-efficient cars, which operate. And Europeans drive the efficient fleet that we will have if Congress enacts a 35-mile-a-gallon fuel economy standard, which is great. It doesn't totally solve the CO2 problem, but it is a step in the right direction. But I'm telling you, if you go out and survey Americans as to whether they, you know, a majority of them want to drive around in European-sized cars, I think it's a marketing job that has yet to be done.
Let's go to Susan in Belmont, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In an attempt to get away from fossil fuels, I myself am driving a diesel VW Beetle, which has been retrofitted to use an auxiliary tank that uses waste vegetable oil. So I drive on a combination of biodiesel, which I have to travel 10 or 15 miles to fill my tank up with, and waste vegetable oil, which I just have to go down the street to my local Chinese restaurant to get. Two questions.
Mm.
One question is, when we're talking about plug-in electric cars, all energy has to come from somewhere.
Yep.
Those power plants that are making that electricity are using, for the most part in this country, dirty fuels to make it.
Mm-hmm.
So while that might help with local pollution in an urban area, I don't see necessarily how that's going to solve our carbon emissions problem. The second question is, What I see as a very good alternative would be a diesel car, which was a diesel-electric hybrid. Also, in my case, I would prefer to also have an auxiliary waste fuel tank. And in that way, in the city, I could use electricity. On long trips, I could use either biodiesel or waste vegetable oil, and I wouldn't be using fossil fuel at all, either to generate the electricity or in the tank itself. So I know that in Europe, they have been looking at making these diesel-electric hybrids, and I'm wondering if your guest has any idea at what stage they are in development.
Susan, let me just ask you, because you sound so marvelously proactive here. I mean, you're filling up already on, what, Kung Pao chicken oil. Do you think cars are going to be turned around, greened up in time to, to avoid the cliff, if there's a cliff out there?
I really have no idea. I mean, I drive around in Europe a lot and pay that, $6 a gallon for diesel, and I definitely prefer to drive those smaller cars. I think that, that's the way to go, and I think it's ludicrous to think that, we need to give people a way to make themselves feel good about driving SUVs around suburban shopping malls. I don't see that as a solution. But I think that diesel has always had a bad rap because of particulate emissions. And
yeah.
I think that with the new diesel engines, that the particulates have been, except for NOx, I think particulates have been cut way down. And so I think that diesel is actually a greener fuel to biodiesel is a greener fuel to produce than is ethanol, in to my understanding. And I think that the problem is, people always say, well, if you have all that land that's being used to grow fuel crops, you're not going to have enough land to grow food crops. And I think that the solution to that, I think, was provided by Einstein when he said that if humanity is going to save itself, we have to become vegetarians because, it takes a lot less land to produce vegetables than it does to produce vegetables for cattle.
Susan, you're great, and you've got Einstein right here at the table with us. Thank you very much for that. Vijay, here's your Great Awakening audience in spades. I mean, Susan's already sort of doing it on her own hook, but she's got big questions for you. Number one, plug-ins, where does all that juice come from, that electricity? It's produced somehow. And what about biodiesel? Is that a way out of the dirty car trap?
Sure. Great questions. And I'm delighted to see her innovation at the front lines of this revolution. I think that, the right way forward, as I've argued already in this hour, is let 1,000 flowers bloom. There's no silver bullet. There's no single solution that's clear that's going to defeat the oil economy. I think it's a little naive to think that. And so I'm delighted to see her experimenting. She asked an important question about plug-in electric cars, which is broadly a question about cars that use electricity. Aren't they really just pollute somewhere else vehicles, right?
That's using the kind coal, of, basically. It means comes
and,
back to
and
coal.
We all know that the American electricity grid has it's about 55% coal. Mm-hmm. A lot of that coal is burned very inefficiently in these old pulverized coal plants, on average over 30 years. I mean, they're a bunch of old clunkers, let's be honest about it, and they're not very clean. And so, most people, particularly those who don't like electricity, the hydrogen advocates or the guys who are the old grease and grime, so old-style gasoline engine guys, like my old classmates at MIT, I'm an old mechanical engineer myself, say, look, electric cars, come on, it's a big scam. It's a pollute somewhere else vehicle. It's clean right here, but the grid itself is dirty, so
our
it's time's no
short.
Point.
Let's hear it. Where do you go with it?
The punchline, the best studies done on this topic, including by the Californian regulators, show even with today's grid, if you plug in an electric car, you get lower emissions than the average new car using gasoline off Detroit. And in future, since we're decarbonizing the grid, everyone agrees America's grid is going to clean up. The advantage over today's car can only improve as the grid becomes greener.
Joe White, what do you see there in Tokyo? The Tokyo Auto Show opening up this week, I think you've got an advanced glimpse. Is the curtain coming up on something like what Vijay's describing or not?
There's going to be a number of concept vehicles here of fairly small, sustainable mobility is the phrase of the moment, vehicles, small things that you can run around in a congested urban environment. We didn't even talk about congestion, but that's a big, or I didn't, but that's a big deal. So yes, you're going to see that, but you know what? You're also going to see the auto industry's schizophrenia on this in full display, because both Nissan and Toyota are going to showcase production cars that are 500 horsepower supercars.
Wow.
Just completely the wrong message. So you know, these guys can't help themselves. And it goes back to a point I tried to make earlier, or I did make, which is that to some degree, you know, the car business has got to make a decision about whether they're going to sell these virtues of fuel economy and sustainability with the same vigor that they have sold features like all-wheel drive and 500 horsepower.
Will it be a whole new set of players who finally sell that other kind of car? Do you think, Joe, can the current executives really get enthusiastic about that?
Well, they're probably going to have to, or they're going to get new executives. I got to say, I'm skeptical. Maybe because I've been at the Wall Street Journal for too long, I'm skeptical of startup car companies that have, you know, 1/100th of the capital that
right.
you need to really do this stuff. I wish him well. I interviewed one of the guys who founded Tesla not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
He's a smart guy. He's got a great vision. He's got $105 million, and to paraphrase an old joke in Detroit, you know, give the man one blue chip.
Right. We got a big world to move in a hurry. Joseph White, Detroit Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for being with us from Tokyo.
Anytime.
And Vijay Vaitheswaran, co-author with Ian Carson of Zoom, The Global Race to Fuel the Car of the Future. Vijay, we love your enthusiasm and your optimism and your ideas. We're going to keep close track of them. Good luck to us all in having some of them work out, and thanks for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.